Okay, and now we're going to talk about computer-supported cooperative work. So this is actually a class I used to have in the intro class, and then we went from 8 sessions to 7, so it went away. But this year I've been going a bit faster than usual, so you get to see this. So this has been a subject of interest to me for a long time, because we all know about, you know, the personal computer, the PC. You know that PC means personal computer? Yes. So personal computer. Now, that sounds like a nice thing, having your own personal computer. But I think in a sense, computers have become a little bit too personal. In the sense that they've been designed for really one person using one computer in one particular setting, which is typically sitting at the desk. Or at least that was the case until just a few years ago. Now, of course, we have devices that we use on the run, on the go, and in more context. But we also have more and more tools to help us do things together, right? However, my take is that this has always been sort of an afterthought. We started with personal computing, and then we added things to do networking, to do sharing, to do all these things, communication and all that. But it was not thought from the start as fundamental features of, say, the graphical user interface. Actually, it's not totally true, because the original Xerox Star was pretty good at making network resources available on your desktop computer as if they were literally on your machine. But since then, the networking stuff has always sort of been something added after the fact. Yet humans are social beings. Groups structure human activity. And you can see signs of that from as far as you can go in the archaeological record, of seeing, you know, humans organized as tribes. Division of labor has been in place for a very long time. And nowadays it shows in professional life, private life. And the reason that groups are a good thing is because a group can be more than the sum of its parts. A group can achieve more collectively than individual people could do separately. Through division of labor, which lets you take advantage of different expertise, so you don't have to be a specialist in everything. So you can have, you know, the people who go get the food in the forest and the others who cook the food, and et cetera. And also, to support group activity, of course, there is the key aspect of teaching and learning, of transmitting stuff you learn, getting it transmitted to you from the group, and then from you to, children and colleagues and etc. So humans are social beings. I hope everybody agrees with that. But as I said, computers have been designed mostly for personal use. And that was even the case when we were using these big so-called time-sharing systems, where, you know, there was a big computer, but it was used by multiple people. And the operating systems that led to Unix, but all the other ones, Multics or VAX VMS or IBM 360 and all that, were designed so even though you were sharing a computer with others, it would look like you were the only user. And that was what time sharing was about, is we slice time in little slices. I give you a slice, I give you a slice, I give you a slice, and I feel like I have, you know, the computer for myself. And for example, in the file system, the assumption and all the tools that have been built to control access, for example, so that my files cannot be touched by the person next to me, are to support this idea of individual use. So Don Norman, him again, in his book has said, you know, most work done on any complex entity is done by more than one person. That sounds pretty obvious to me, but it's good to say it. But he's also said that the social impact of technology is hard to predict. I think we see ample proof of this these days with the effect of social networks, for example, which on the one hand has been a tool used by groups of people to emancipate themselves and to, you know, create movements in various countries. So in a sense, in a, well, some people would say in a good way. But at the same time, the same social networks are used to propagate fake news and for more negative purposes. Nobody had anticipated these things. Well, should never say nobody, because of course there's some people who would have predicted it, but nobody thought it would happen so quickly and at such a large scale. So I've already talked about Engelbart as being really the first to really develop a vision that the use of computers should be collective and should be done to augment the collective human intellect. And the systems he built, NLS Augment, was supporting file sharing. It was supporting personal annotations of this shared documents. It was supporting electronic messaging between people, video conferencing, screen sharing, telepointers, etc. So already in the 60s, he understood that we should design collective computers, not maybe personal computers, or at least a lot of collective features should be built into the system. So that was in the 60s. The field that is now known as CSCW, which was the acronym on the very first slide, Computer Supported Cooperative Work, which is kind of a mouthful, CSCW, which is also criticized nowadays because computer, okay, supported, yes, cooperative, yes, work, but why just work? You know, we use computers to support collective activities, not just for work, but also for leisure and for, you know, our personal lives, etc. But that's how it came out. It's also sometimes called groupware, which is a nice word, I find. Groupware tends to be the software that is used for CSCW. These are the terms that are in French. And the first conferences in the field came out in the mid-80s, so, you know, sort of almost 20 years after Engelbart, before this field was recognized as a field of research itself, came out essentially out of the field of office information systems, how computers were getting into offices for a lot of different types of tasks, which involves collective organizations. And so there are several definitions of CSCW because in the same way as HCI is really the confluence mostly of computer science on the one hand and human psychology on the other, CSCW is at the confluence of, again, computer science and this time sociology. Now, sociologists and psychologists are very different types of people. And my impression that there's been a kind of a battle of different brands of sociologists with respect to the development of CSCW tools and groupware. In psychology, people really try to understand human behavior so as to, in a sense, model and, some, when possible, predict it. But it's really based on understanding the underlying mechanism in the brain or in our motor or sensory system. Sociologists tend to be a step back, look at organizations, at groups of people, but they are not so much interested in interventions to change these social groups. They're more observers and trying also to understand why a group operates the way it does. But a lot of people from sociology are very reluctant to introducing technology in a group as a means to solve problems. And so that led to different factions in CSCW. So one of them is from Liam Bannon and Kiel Schmidt here, where they consider that CSCW is really an endeavor to understand the nature and characteristics of cooperative work with the objective of designing adequate computer-based technologies. So the focus is really on understanding group work and sometime coming to the conclusion that, you know, technology is not going to solve the problem, which is more often than you think the case. When there was this big wave of, you know, putting computers into companies to do, you know, the payroll, to do managing the stock, to manage human resources, etc., something worked well and some things were pure disasters because they were based on the idea that the organization that was not working well would work better with the computer in the middle. In general, that is not the case. And so here, this is a more social science take on CSCW. And then we have the other side, which is from Skip Ellis, Simon Gibbs, and Ryan, I don't remember his first name, around the same time, which is really based on engineering. So, okay, we're going to build computer-based system that support groups of people that are engaged in a common task, and these systems are designed to provide an interface to a shared environment. So they're, you know, focusing on the technology. And that's fine. I mean, if they can talk to each other, that's fine. And then there's another description here that, in a sense, tried to distinguish what is different between this type of software and the rest of software, including interactive software. So it is different in the basic assumption that groupware has to make the user aware of that he is or she is part of a group and that what the rest of the group is doing. While most other software, in fact, seeks to hide the other users, as I was saying before. When you are, you know, logged in into a cloud system, you don't know who else is on the cloud. And it's designed to give you this illusion that you are the only user. So that's for them the key difference is this notion of awareness. And awareness is a key word in groupware. And so for now, you know, 30, 40 years, the challenge has been to decide, well, you know, what should these groupware systems do? How do we create groupware? What are the new or the additional principles or aspects of human sociology that we need to take into account to design systems that work? How do they affect use? And so it mixes sociology, as I mentioned, also ethnography and anthropology, which are studies of human behavior as social beings, and of course design, computer science, and the usual elements that we also find in HCI. But I think, certainly in HCI, understanding humans is key to designing better systems. In CSCW, of course, understanding humans and groups is important. But I think it's also the case that the solutions are not always, and in fact, rarely purely technical. What I mean by that is, at the same time as people adopt a groupware system, they also create their own social norms. You all know about netiquette, the sort of behavior you are supposed to have when you are on social networks in general. These are social norms created by the groups in order to be able to use the technology in a way that is productive, shall I say. Oops. So, one way to analyze, again, remember the descriptive, predictive, generative. So at least at the descriptive level, The way we can look at the systems is by the key functionality that they support. And a very common way of doing this is distinguishing between three aspects: sharing, coordination, and communication. So communication, you all know. Communication is exchanging information between humans. So in communication, the computer is just there to transmit information. So I send email, you know, I type an email address and I expect the system to figure out how to get that email to the recipient. And it can be asynchronous communication like with email, or of course direct communication like with Skype or instant messaging. Then we have sharing, which is that we create computer artifacts, documents, for example, like in Google Docs, that can be simultaneously used by different users. And here the challenge is how to give the illusion that everybody is working on the same document, say, even though people are scattered around the world. And the third aspect, which is oftentimes sort of omitted because it's, the third aspect is coordination. And that's all the time we spend to organize the division of labor. All the time we spend sending messages and doing doodle things to find a moment to meet. All the emails we exchange to organize who's going to do which part of which project, etc., etc. So this is called coordination work. Now, sometimes this is not this is confused with communication and sharing, because oftentimes there is no explicit coordination tool, and so people coordinate their action through a communication channel, such as over email, or through shared artifacts, such as a doodle, you know doodle, right, to make appointments? Yeah. But it's still a specific activity that is key to groupware, and for which there are specific systems and approaches that have been built. So what I'm going to do now is to go very quickly, since there's another half hour, over a set of categories of groupware systems. And for those of you who will take the elective, then the following classes will sort of go deeper into each of these categories. But I think it's probably not bad to have first an overview. Before I get there, do you have any question? No. You move your hand, so I thought... Sorry. No questions?
Are you going to teach this subject? Are you going to teach this subject?
Am I going to teach? I'm teaching it right now.
No. After this class? Maybe.
Well, in the groupware class, I shared the class with Cédric Fleury. So he's teaching three classes and I'm teaching four. It's just that this year I couldn't do the first one, which is this overview. But I'll do the second one, and we haven't scheduled exactly when we're doing it, but it's we're doing it jointly. Okay, so here's the list, but let's get started. Email. You guys still use email? Yeah. But for the boring stuff, right? Yeah, that's what I noticed with my kids. If I want to get to them, email is not going to do it. So email is very old. It was created originally because there were very few computers in the world, and they were also specialized. And so people, the operators of these computers, needed to sometimes to get a job sent to another center that could do the calculation and then get the results back. And so what I find interesting in this story is that originally people were exchanging messages as attachments to the data they needed processed at another place. And now we exchange messages where we attach the data that we, you know, need to transmit around. Anyway, the point of the Information Lens project here was that some people, in fact, Wendy is one of the person, I think she's the one who did probably the earliest study of email overload. So already in the 80s, she anticipated that people would suffer from email overload one day. How many emails do you receive a day? I mean, I'm not counting spam. Ah, yeah, no, it would be too easy. Hmm? Five. You're lucky. 20? 20, okay. Do you call that overload? Yeah. Yeah.
Notification and said
1,000. Yeah. Well, nowadays, yes, because a lot of these channels are used also for similar activities. But in fact, yesterday I was sorting some of my email, and I keep all my email in my inbox. So currently, I have 50,000 messages in my inbox. And once in a while, I dump them in a folder by year. And I move them month by month. And I was doing that yesterday for last year's email. And I typically, excluding spam, I typically have 1,500 to 2,000 emails per month. So email overload. So how do you address email overload? So the idea in the information lens was to help people filter their email. How many of you are using email filters? Okay. Do they work for you? No. But anyway, so Tom Malone, was at the MIT, created this system called an information lens that was really the precursor to all this filtering emails. So you could create filters based on where the email is from, who is it to. You could add your own headers to the email. His idea was an email is semi-structured. There is a structured part here with the headers, and there is text here, and we don't care about that. But there's information in there that is significantly understandable for a computer on which you can base filters or do things like putting things in your schedule automatically. And so you could create your own rules to process email and to pre-write answers or sorted and etc. And so it's interesting that email has not really changed in 50 years, still is the most widely used communication means. I will talk more stories about the information lens in the class, but that was an example of a communication software. Another example of shared editing is Colab. So Colab was an experiment put together in the late 80s at the Xerox PARC lab, like many of these things at that time, where they created a room which, if you look at it, is really similar to the one I was showing before from Engelbart, which was here on the left. So a meeting room with computers on the desk, on the various desks. Where am I? And a large shared electronic whiteboard. And so they concentrated on how this technology could be useful for meetings. And what you do in meetings is not the same thing that you do when you're back in your office. So they created three software to share external memory of what was going on in the meeting. Board Noter was just a hand-drawing tool, so you could draw like you draw on the board. Cognoter was to outline ideas, so an outlining tool, but it was shared. And ArcNoter was a system that was designed so you could keep track of how decisions are made with arguments and counter-arguments, so that you draw this with a sort of graph, and that gets archived, so then next time you can remember why you came up with that decision. Because oftentimes in meetings, we come to decisions, and then the next meeting, someone who wasn't there says, oh, but why did you do that? And nobody really remembers, or everybody remembers, but in different ways of what happened. And so it was a way to keep track of that. The key thing, though, is they invented sort of a key vocabulary that is in use when we talk about sharing documents and real-time sharing of documents, real-time editing. So they introduce this notion of WYSIWYS. What you see is what I see. You remember WYSIWYG? Yes? Which meant what? What you see is what you get. What you see on the screen is what you get on the printer. Here it's WYSIWYS. What you see is what I see. So really sharing the same content of the screen as if we were looking at the same screen. But what they anticipated is that this was too strict, too strong. And so they introduced WYSIAWYS. What you see is almost what I see, which is a relaxed form of congruence, which is what you experience in Google Docs. If you're sharing a document on Google Docs, well, you're sharing the same document, but you're not sharing the same view. You can be at the beginning of a document, and I can be looking at the end, right? And so they listed, I think, seven different aspects in which the strict congruence could be relaxed. Sometimes you want to do it in time rather than in space, so that what you type is only for yourself until you're happy for everybody else to see it. So that would be a time filter on the shared document. And so shared editing has been long studied the topic where over the years a number of systems have been built. Systems for asynchronous text editing where typically it's the review cycle things where I edit a document. Then I say, well, I want your comments and your suggestions. So I send it around. People make their changes. Here in this tool, the changes are shown on the right. And then document comes back to me. Or someone else who decides, well, I'll take this change or I won't take this one. So this is what we call asynchronous, but there's also a lot of work on synchronous editing, what has become nowadays, you know, things like Google Docs or, you know, Microsoft and Apple have now similar things. I don't know if you realize that this is very recent, that these things have been around and used widely. 5 years ago, it was still not really quite so widespread. We did work in this area in the early 90s on looking at shared editing. The Grove editor, which is the first one that was built by Skip Ellis and his colleagues, had interesting features that we don't necessarily have today. For example, showing the text that has been edited recently so that someone who comes in the document can see where there is stuff going on. So he had text that was first blue and then turned black over time. So you looked for blue text means recent changes. And that is the type of awareness I was talking about. You want to know, you know, you're not the only author of changes to a document. So you don't have this memory in your head of what you have done to the document. So how do you build an understanding of what's happened when it's done by others? And awareness features are essentially about knowing, understanding, having access to what others have done or are doing. And they had another one, which was to put clouds around the text that was being edited. I don't know if you've seen that, but in Google Doc, I find it sometimes annoying as a viewer to see a bunch of changes happening that I don't really care about and that are, you know, distracting me. So if there's a cloud there, it's something, well, someone is working there, so don't go there, essentially. That would be enough. As an author, I also, and I do that a lot with my students, where they give me the paper they're writing, and then I rewrite it or edit it. And I feel like I see their cursors there, and I feel like it's like looking over my shoulder. And I don't know about you, but it doesn't. I'm not comfortable, you know, showing the messiness of my editing. And so there, I would also like to say, well, you know, show them I'm working there, but wait a bit to show the result. And so that's where all these aspects that are not technical, because technically we can do real-time updates, but sort of the social aspects of people, you know, not wanting to see, to show everything they do, but still wanting to share their activity, where we want to build all these sort of means of awareness without being completely whizzy-whiz to get back to that term. So that was an example of sharing. So in that context, there is interesting stuff I'll talk about in the class about the algorithms that are used to do this real-time editing, because there's some computer science-y stuff there. The third aspect about coordination is best exemplified by the coordinator, which is a system by Vinograd and Flores from the it's also the 80s. It's in the next slide. Yeah, 88. So the idea for workflow systems came from analyzing how documents are processed in a company, where typically you get a document, like an order, for example, and it has to go to someone who's going to check that there is the thing in stock, to someone else who's going to do the invoicing. So there's all these workflows, literally, that happen with physical documents. And how can you turn this into online systems where the system knows that, you know, this document is waiting to be signed or approved by this person, and that person has to do changes and returning to that other person, etc. So the idea of workflows that to have sort of intelligent documents, documents that know where they're supposed to go in that process. And the coordinator was a system that let people, so it was based on something called speech acts, the idea that when we communicate with others, we use what Searle called speech acts to say, I'm asking you to do this, and then you say, well, no, I can't do it for this date, but I'd be willing to do it for, you know, another week, and then you promise you're going to do this, and then a week after you haven't done it, so I come and I nag you, etc. So he has this automaton here, a state machine, of all the possibilities, request and decline or counter the offer and promise and then etc. That operationalized in the system this very fluid types of communication we have from human to human. This is an interesting story because there was a whole big controversy around the coordinator, especially from people coming from social science, saying, well, you cannot put human social behavior in terms of this kind of boxes and arrows and expect that, you know, things are that simple. You know, intuitively, we know they're not that simple. And so there was also a political agenda behind the coordinator that is a whole story in itself. Yes? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, that's the thing. Because when you look at organizations from a sociological perspective, most organizations are hierarchical, right? And what you observed is the managers tend to have an idealized view of how the people under them are supposed to work, right? And the computer systems, when they were brought into enterprises, were built based on the requirements defined by the managers, which were then disconnected from the actual needs from their subordinates.
This is automating, like, a yeah. whole department of a company.
Yes.
Like the management of documents, for example.
Right. I don't think so. So I think a lot of the systems have really been bad for organizations. They have disorganized things that were otherwise working. They've also been presented as solving problems in an organization, which they don't. There is an interesting case study of the system called Lotus Notes, which was done by Lotus, but then acquired by IBM. Which combine an internal email system with a workflow system with a bunch of things. And there is a case study where it was introduced in two companies, In the first one, it was just imposed top-down, and it was a disaster. It didn't work for the people. People didn't want to use it. They felt like they were tracked all the time, and etc. In the other company, the introduction was done after a kind of participatory process with the employees to explain to them how it worked and what level of control they had and what feature they wanted, and that was a much better better story. So that's the thing, is technology alone doesn't solve social problems in organizations.
But doesn't it cut back on time? So if there's an author, editor, and manager,
yeah.
Instead of emailing back and forth, are you done? Email it back to me, let's proofread it. They can just kind of use a system.
Well, they can use a system. It is a system that's going to nag you. Yeah, but it also means that it's nagging you, so it can keep track of how many times it sent you that email to remind you, and then it can report that to the manager, so at your next evaluation, you're going to be. So it was this idea that instead of being in control of the system was controlling the workers.
I worked on a couple of these teams that they were pretty flexible. The goal was to substitute email and print the stuff. So. You do the same job, but you just follow the system instead of printing and sending a manual email.
Well, there's a whole, it's not all negative. And transforming paper documents going around into electronic documents that can be signed electronically and transferred electronically as good sign. But there is an example that, I'll tell to you. It was at the Xerox. Company whose business was to sell photocopiers had, of course, an online system not for people to place the orders themselves, but you would call the person and she would take, usually it's a woman, she would take the order on the computer. And so that means filling out a form on the computer. Now, the minute you do that, it means that it's the order of the form that's going to dictate how you want the person placing the order to give you the information. Whereas a human being would say first, the address and the time and the this and that. So already when your interaction is sort of mediated by this computer system, it will change the nature of how you interact with the customer. And in that case, the person was taking the order said, well, where should it be delivered? And the person, the customer ordering it said, well, when is it going to be delivered? And the person said, well, in order to tell you when, I need to know where. And the other said, well, in order to know where, you need to tell me when. Now, that sounds like a really annoying customer. But in fact, the real story is that the customer was on a ship. And so the ship is moving. It's not going to stay in the harbor until the thing gets delivered. And the computer system had no way to say, on the paper order, you would write in the margin saying, well, this is a special situation. When it can be delivered, I will tell you where, etc. The system was rigid. It needed to know the where before the telling you the when, and it was blocking you. And that's what we see in all this workflow and other systems that automate business processes is they are very rigid. And human organizations work because we have room in the margins. and so that's where that was one aspect of the big battles that went with the system. But, now these systems are absolutely everywhere in companies, and companies like SAP have made a fortune destroying organizations and then pretending to fix them with the next version of their system and stuff like that. Okay, so other things that I like to talk about is from communication to social networking. I remember in 1982, the first time I used Unix Talk. So you know the Talk program on Unix? Very fancy program. It splits the terminal window in half. You type at the top, and you see what the other person at the other end is typing at the bottom. And I was talking to a friend of mine who was in the US, and I was fascinated that, you know, I could type on the screen and she would see the thing instantly on the other side of the Atlantic. And then I realized, but I could pick up my phone and talk to that person. And so why is that more magic somehow? But there is something magic about human-to-human communication. And we'll see other examples in video-mediated communication in particular. What's interesting is that a lot of technologies that were designed for communication have been sort of appropriated by users, starting with the telephone. The telephone was meant originally for one-to-many communication. It was designed to be used, say, on the floors of a department store so that the boss or the head of the store could talk to all his employees at once. And I don't think that's used very much anymore. But then it made a success by becoming a person-to-person communication medium. And so there's been many systems over the years that have been developed to support this kind of person-to-person communication or group communication using computer technology. So this is an early type of chat room, which was, of course, the classical thing where people can type their messages. But this circle here shows the list of users. They have colored dots. And so in the circle, they are closer to the center if they're active in the conversation, and those that are less active are on the side, so you get a sense of, you know, who is engaged in the particular conversation. These are other types of visualization for what's happening in the conversation. And early on, people realized that, you know, people have tended to create tools that were designed for one particular feature. So either it's going to be real-time type of chat room, or it's going to be, like here, a kind of wall where you can stick post-it notes, so it's more what we call asynchronous. I can post something now, and you'll see it the next time you open that window. And each of these tools were sort of developed independently. And one characteristic of group work is that it evolves over time. At one time, we want to have a meeting together to be, you know, synchronized on talking about a particular topic. Then we're done with the meeting. We each go our separate ways, do a piece of the work. Then we come back again. So there is this ebb and flow of working simultaneously or asynchronously, sharing documents and having other sort of synchronization activities. And I think one problem with groupware systems in general is that they have tended to address one feature at a time. And the reason people use email and Snapchat and Messenger and this and that, in fact, we've done studies on this, asking why do you use all these communication apps? And what people told us is that they segregate their social circles according to what applications. So people tend to use Skype with the family. Yes. WeChat or Snapchat is going to be for a particular circle, and another one, it's going to be Slack for the professional circle, etc. Now, why wouldn't these applications let you manage these circles rather than forcing you to use different applications for different purposes when their features are, in general, fairly similar to each other? What has been, fascinating in a sense of both exciting and depressing has been to watch the emergence of social networks. I think it's interesting to compare how all these social networks have emerged. A number of these are probably dead by now because this is an old picture. How come, you know, one particular social network has reached like over 2 billion users? And how we've come to these situations of dominance, especially if you compare what a social network does to, say, what email does. When you use email, you know, my email account and provider is the university. I'm sure some of you are on Gmail, some are on Outlook. I read my mail with the Apple Mail program. Some of you use Thunderbird or Outlook. We can still all talk to each other. I need one address for each of you to reach you by email. But then social networks which essentially provide the same type functionality from each other. You know, you have your circle of friends, you want to send messages, then there are little differences, but essentially they are the same. You need to have a Facebook account and a Snapchat account and an Instagram account and et cetera, because they all created these silos to be insulated from each other for business purposes. But I don't think it's in the interest of the users. It also means that the dominant players also tend to have maybe a little bit too much power, and also, there's sort of social and political implications to all that. So my talk about social networks is that hopefully, you know, it will evolve to be more in the service of its users, which I think currently are more often than not manipulated by the social networks, unfortunately. But I don't have time to say more. To finish quickly, because I see time is running out, we'll talk, we won't talk about network games, but it's an interesting topic for group activities. Again, there's been a stark transition from just a few years ago where now every new game that comes out has to be a network game, otherwise it won't make it, which is fairly recent. And I think in the same way as interaction techniques are there's more creativity in interaction techniques in games, I think the way the game networking has been designed and deployed is quite interesting, and I think it's ahead of the game from other types of platforms for large groups of users, because here you have really real-time, you know, rich real-time interaction. We'll talk about video-mediated communication. Again, long story behind that, but the ability to see each other, in addition to be able to talk to each other, is really a powerful medium. And it's a powerful medium when you combine seeing and talking to each other with sharing documents. And there are a number of systems have been built to create this shared space, which we call the media space, to support this virtual shared space without going to virtual reality and avatars and all that. Now, everybody uses Skype. But Skype is a very, again, limited type of video communication, and we'll see, for those, again, of you who take the class, other alternatives. Cédric will talk about collaborative virtual environments from the fancy avatars here. You see these two guys, red guy and the green guy in Dive in 91 to Second Life. Anybody here is using Second Life? Yes, go. I discovered recently there's people working in virtual reality are running a conference, a virtual conference that is run in Second Life, where they have built a virtual conference center with virtual meeting rooms and all that. So it was interesting to see that this was still alive. Then I will skip about this and finish with crowdsourcing. I think that then there is this, I don't know if it's the next step, but something that has also emerged very recently was the idea of combining the collective intellect, to use the Doug Engelbart's terms, of humans, together with the computational capabilities of computers, or sometimes it's put the other way around, how computers can harness the power of the crowd. And this is crowdsourcing. Anybody here knows about Amazon Mechanical Turk? Yes, people in the back. Have you been Turkers? No, that's the... Anyway, so the idea here, and the Mechanical Turk is this automaton that was traveled around Europe in the 1700s, pretended to be a machine that played chess and that was very good at chess. And in fact, there was a small person inside the machine that was playing chess. And so Mechanical Turk, it was presented as being this Turk turban guy. Mechanical Turk has become the term used by that community to talk about people who are essentially working for the machine. So, you know, all these AI programs that do image recognition or that do all these things, to feed the AI algorithms, you need to label a lot of images. Well, the companies that do that, they don't do the labeling themselves. They hire people online to do it through these Mechanical Turk platforms. And they call this harnessing the power of the crowd, which is all nice and good, except these people tend to be paid a third of minimum wage, according to a recent study. And so this idea of combining human intelligence with machine, I don't like to say intelligence, but with machine computation is very exciting. For example, this folded program, they've put online a program for people to figure out how molecules fold in 3D, and it helped the researchers making discoveries about certain molecules that they were not able to do just by pure computation or with their own manpower. So it can be for really the greater good, but it also has implications on what does it mean to work in this kind of environment where your job is actually, your boss is actually an algorithm rather than a human being, which leads to things like companies like Uber and others that say they are disruptive, and they are disruptive in the sense that they're destroying the social fabric by completely destroying the notion of a work contract. So there are lots of implications there that are social and, again, political. I'm going to close here where our dear TAs, have they? Yeah, they're here. Okay, you were hiding. So I'm done. This I'll show in intro class. These were some references. I'll put the slide online. I really think that groupware is really an area where there is still a lot to imagine and to invent. But I think at the same time, the problem is that, you know, you've been embedded in all these existing tools, social networks and others that make it hard to think outside of that box. And I think we've created all these siloed applications that are insulated from each other. And I think there's a lot of things to do to have systems that are more open and interoperable and to support more diversity in the things we do online. And there's also key features on how to address the challenges of what happens when these things scale at a billion of users, which was never really anticipated. Okay, any questions? No? Well done. Okay, well, thank you. It was nice seeing you again. We'll see you next week. Yes? You'll be the one working for once. okay, I'll leave Raphael and Emmanuel take over.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. The last session of the TA before the exam. Sorry to recall that. But we'll prepare you for that. We'll spend the next 1 hour and a half doing one, two exercises from previous exams with you and correcting.